From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a recipe for blood, stage blood. Tom Savini built his reputation with the gruesome special makeup effects he created for films like Dawn of the Dead and Friday the 13th. Now Savini has directed his first feature film, a remake of George Romero's classic Night of the Living Dead. Also today, we meet West Indian writer Jamaica Kincaid. Her new novel is based on her own experiences coming to the U.S. from the small island of Antigua. World music critic Milo Miles checks out what they're listening to in India. And TV critic David Bianculli previews WIOU, a new CBS sitcom about a TV station. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush has vetoed a major civil rights bill designed to combat discrimination in the workplace. The veto was expected. The administration has argued against the bill during its passage through Congress, maintaining that it would force employers to adopt hiring and promotion quotas. The measure was designed to nullify six Supreme Court decisions that have made it more difficult for women and minorities to prove and win job discrimination suits. Neither the House nor the Senate passed the measure by a wide enough margin to override a presidential veto. An Arab-American delegation from Michigan, which has been in Iraq for a week, says it now has a commitment from Saddam Hussein to bring home Americans who are sick or elderly. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
Salim Mansour, an American from Detroit, says he doesn't know how many sick or elderly Americans he'll be allowed to take out of Baghdad this week. But the American Embassy in Baghdad has identified 69 Americans who qualify as being either sick or over the age of 55. This is the second so-called humanitarian release that Baghdad has agreed to in as many days. Yesterday, former British Prime Minister Ted Heath said that he would be taking home British citizens who are sick or over 55, and the British Embassy has identified 53 such people. Some of the foreign nationals being held in Iraq are very ill, even terminally ill, but so far they've been kept in a hospital and not allowed to leave the country. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
In Israel today, security forces closed a tense Jerusalem to Arabs to prevent further violence after a Palestinian stabbed to death three Israelis in a Jewish neighborhood in the city. Patricia Golan reports that Arab residents from the Israeli-occupied territories will be prevented from entering Jerusalem again tomorrow.
Police say the decision to extend the ban was made because of continuing tension in Jerusalem following yesterday's killings. The 19-year-old Arab laborer arrested for the murders was apparently seeking revenge for the October 8th killings by police of 21 Palestinians in Jerusalem. Yesterday, enraged Jewish residents stoned Arab-owned cars yelling death to the Arabs. Cabinet Minister Ehud Olmert defended the ban on Palestinians coming to the city as the only way to protect them.
The city is a one city. Thousands of Arabs are wandering around in various parts of the city. There is no way that you can follow each and every one of them and provide personal and individual protection for everyone.
There was another stabbing by an Arab of an Israeli Jew in Jerusalem today. Normally, the incident would attract little attention, but in the overheated atmosphere in Israel today, any such act escalates the violence here. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Indications of a potentially peaceful solution to the Persian Gulf crisis pushed oil prices to their biggest one-day drop in history today. Prices dropped by more than $5 a barrel. The Dow Industrials lost nearly 5 points to close at 2,516. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The bodies of the recently dead are returning to life again in the new updated version of Night of the Living Dead. These unsightly zombies originally rose from the dead in George Romero's 1968 horror classic. Romero is the executive director and co-writer of the remake. He asked Tom Savini to direct. Savini is a wizard of special makeup effects. Gore is his specialty. If you need to show a victim with an axe in his skull, or a young man slicing his arm open with a razor, or a zombie gnawing on a human thigh, Savini is your man. He did the makeup effects for Romero's zombie sequels Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead. The only Romero film he didn't work on was the original Night of the Living Dead. Savini also did special effects makeup for Friday the 13th, Maniac, and Creepshow. He directed several episodes of the TV series Tales from the Dark Side, but Night of the Living Dead is his debut as a feature film director. I asked him why George Romero wanted to remake a film that's already a classic.
Well, when I read interviews where they ask him that question, he says, plain and simple, for financial reasons. And I don't think that means that he's greedy or anything like that. I think that, one, he owns the title, and when you're shopping what you own around, you know, that's something that you possess and can get, you know, financing for. But the other reason is that the original film made a fortune, but he and his investors made nothing. It was a bad business deal. Now this is the opportunity for him to finally repay himself and those investors.
What did you want to keep faithful to the original movie, and what did you want to change?
I wanted to make sure that that people were reminded from the very beginning. I think George was counting on the fact that most people know the first film. And with his script, I think using that knowledge, we were able to manipulate people who expecting the plot to be similar or the same. After the first twist or turn, then they don't know what to expect. And we can make it more suspenseful and intense based on that.
Did you enjoy having other people do this special makeup for the movie?
Oh, of course. I used to go home with blood all over me every day, you know, when I was doing the effects. However, you know, when I was doing the effects, I was only in charge of that department, being the director, you know, in charge of all the departments. But I still got my hands in on the effects. You know, I was helping them throw bodies on the fire, and I did a squib on a guy one night.
The first movie that you made with George Romero was Dawn of the Dead, which was the first sequel to Night of the Living Dead. And a lot of this is set in a shopping mall where, you know, the Walking Dead come back to life and start going up and down escalators and, you know, schlepping through the shopping mall. This was really more graphic, I think, than any other horror movie I can think of that came before it. Was that your intention, to make Dawn of the Dead and The Walking Dead in that movie more graphic than people had seen before on film?
Yeah, well, we had to. Actually, my first film with George was Martin.
Yeah, the vampire movie.
Yeah, but in Dawn of the Dead, I mean, this was the sequel to Night of the Living Dead. Now, when I first saw Night of the Living Dead, you know, as an effects guy, I thought that the zombies, the makeups, the effects could have been a lot more sophisticated, more state-of-the-art. What George did was I think George was actually doing the effects on the film. He was using chocolate syrup for blood and mortician's wax for makeups, and having to do everything, you know, that I think that suffered. So in Dawn of the Dead, clearly here's an opportunity, and it was a color film, to do something, I guess we went overboard, more graphic because of how primitive I thought the first film was. I mean, we would sit around thinking about, you know, how to kill people. I mean, that was our daily, you know, our exercise. And we would go to George and say, how about if we took a screwdriver and drove it in a guy's ear? And he would say, okay, you know, and we would just go do it a couple hours later. So it was like Halloween for 3 months, you know, and it was like anything we wanted to do, George would let us do. And I think because it was released unrated, everything stayed in.
Oh, rather than take the X, you released it unrated so you could get
That's
as graphic
what he did,
as you wanted to.
Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of scenes in that movie, as there are some scenes in your new movie, of people taking bites out of each other, people munching on a thigh. What new effects did you have to come up with to show that?
In Night of the Living Dead?
In Dawn.
I did the opposite.
No. In Dawn of the Dead, I mean. Yeah, Night of the Living Dead, there really isn't that much munching.
No, I clearly did not want it to be a splatter film.
Right.
In fact, the only munching that goes on is toward the end.
Toward the very end, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I treated that voyeuristically, as if you were far away watching a bunch of lions feeding, and your mind kind of filled in the gaps. And some people will make it more grotesque, and for some people it'll be a relief not to be, you know, to see all that stuff. To me, movies, splatter movies, like the Friday the 13th and those kinds of films, are pornography. And what I mean by that is they go in, they zoom in for a close-up of the cut throat or the eyes gouging or something like that. The same way in pornography they zoom in for the close-up of you-know-what. Music video deaths, you know, it's very stylized, you know. And that clearly shows that they don't care about the story and the acting, and, you know, because they're going in for this. I mean, clearly when they zoom in for a shot like that, you know where their minds are. It's for the exploitation. It's for the thrill for the second. And I don't want to be that when I grow up. I want to do something sophisticated. I want, I've 40 some years of watching horror films. Why aim for a lower level of that sort of thing? Do you know what I'm saying?
Put you in a pretty odd spot, though, because, for so many years you were the special effects makeup person, and the effects were being used in a context determined by somebody else. So did you often feel that your work was being used in an exploitative way?
Absolutely. Yeah. You're being kind when you said I've been a special effects artist. I've been called the king of splatter, the god of gore. with my name on a film, you expect to see an enormous bloodbath because of. But then again, I didn't write that stuff that I worked on. My job was to take the script and create as realistically as possible what the script called for. And most people don't realize how much art, sculpture, and casting and painting is involved in even splatter films. So for me, it was to create the stuff as realistically as possible. And, of course, I would get all the flack. You're sick. You're demented. How could you do that? Well, again, I didn't write it. I'm an artist creating it. I'm not saying those who write it are, sick or demented. I mean, I'm not in that world. I mean, my job as an artist was to create it as realistically as possible. So I know what you're saying. People will expect, with George Romero's name and my name on it, to be this horrendous bloodbath, but I think, and you've seen the film, I think they'll walk away with a little more respect for who we really are.
So are you going to be staying away from very graphic, violent films now?
Well, I mean, the Hollywood rule, if there's one thing that's absolutely for sure, nothing is for sure. I could get typed, who knows? I mean, the nice thing about the splatter movies is they got my name out. There was an infamy attached to my name. Now I can use my name, and it's gotten me to this point to direct a feature film, and it's a horror movie. I think I'll probably get mostly horror movies, but what I really want to do is action. And you can tell from Night of the Living Dead, it was pretty gutsy. Action, I mean, there were no punches pulled, there were no stunt sound effect kind of. You saw every hit, you saw every collision, I want to do action adventure, swashbuckling, trapeze, kind of most dangerous game-like movies.
Well, let's go back, though, and talk about some of the effects that have made your reputation over the years.
Okay.
And made you so well-known in movies. And why don't we go back to the first Walking Dead movie that you worked on, which was Dawn of the Dead, the sequel to Night of the Living Dead. And this is very graphic. Zombies taking bites out of people, eating thighs. Did you come up with new effects for the movie?
There was a script, but as I said before, we would sit around and invent all sorts of... I would say we added 60 to 70% of the gore into that film. Our job was to sit around and think of ways to kill people. In fact, when George asked me to do the job, he sent me a telegram and said, we have another gig... Think of ways to kill people. Call me. there were so many things that I did 16 stunts in the. I was 16 different zombies getting hit by trucks or slammed or bammed or shot or thrown over a balcony or,
Couldn't find someone else for the job, or do you enjoy this kind of stuff?
Well, no. I mean, I guess they didn't get their act together enough to hire some stunt people. And then, of course, I opened my big mouth saying, "Hey, I can do that stuff."
I'd like to hear more about the makeup that you used for it. It's a movie with a lot of blood. What do you like to use for blood? What's the most realistic-looking blood?
Well, I'm embarrassed about the blood in Dawn of the Dead. It looked like melted crayons. It was terrible. It was a 3M company used to make a blood called 3M Blood. Sometimes it looked good. Most of the time, though, like I said, it looked like melted crayons. The best blood is Dick Smith's formula. Dick Smith is the god of makeup artists. The Godfather, The Sentinel, Midnight Cowboy, Taxi Driver, it goes on and on and on. His formula is basically Cairo corn syrup, red and yellow food coloring, a preservative, and a wedding agent. His is the blood used throughout. Every makeup artist uses his formula.
So you use his formula most of the time now?
Yeah, but not in Dawn of the Dead. Right after that, Friday the 13th, all the other films after that, I used Dick Smith's formula.
What kind of special makeup or casting or whatever did you use when people were eating other people's limbs?
Well, most of that was sausage and bologna and chicken with some kind of a blood-colored barbecue sauce, or some anything that they might have at craft services that day, we would throw in, you know, have them chewing on it. But some people were chewing on some pretty awful things that were laying around for a while.
What do you mean?
Well, you know, like there might have been, a big ham bone or something that... the worst thing was Day of the Dead, when we had a 5-gallon drum of real intestines from a slaughterhouse. We went to Florida to shoot some beach scenes and came back and jumped right into the tearing apart scenes where they were chomping on intestines. And while we were gone, somebody had unplugged the refrigerator. And you can't imagine what it was like, what that stuff smelled like. And we couldn't get new stuff. I mean, these poor extras were with wax up their noses and, you know, English leather on their mustaches and upper lips to try to fight the smell, you know, were chomping on some of the real stuff there.
Did they get sick?
No, it's amazing. The one actor that it happened to was trapped in a floor because we had to tear him in half, and his real body was underneath the floor and a fake body was on top. And I have a video of the actual of the scene, and he was ready to heave any second. You know, luckily we got him out of there in time and away from the aroma.
Did that work for the movie, to have him look that sick?
No, you never saw him sick in the movie. The only cuts they used was when he screamed choke on him when they dragged his legs away. Hey, it's a living, you know.
Does it feel funny talking about this on the air?
I don't think I've ever talked on such a prestigious station about such a horrendous subject before.
Well, sometimes I think about, how's this going to sound, you know?
Somebody just kind of tuning in after, yeah, you know, after breakfast or something. What are they? Who is that, you know?
Well, if anybody is wondering who is that, let me tell you that I'm speaking with Tom Savini, and he's considered one of the wizards of gore. He's a special effects makeup person, and he's done the effects for all of George Romero's movies, with the exception of Night of the Living Dead. And now he's made his directorial debut directing a sequel to Night of the Living Dead.
Actually, it's the retelling. It's the same story.
Yeah. What's the word for that? Remake.
Remake. You can call it a remake. I tend to think of it as a retelling. It's like, if you had to do it over again, what would you do? You know.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And this new version of Night of the Living Dead is about to open. And we'll talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Savini is my guest, and he's been called, King of Splatter, King of Gore? Is
that let's get it straight. God of Gore, right. King of Splatter, Splatter King, Wizard of Gore, Demented Sick,
and so on.
Take your pick.
No, you've just directed the updating of Night of the Living Dead. You weren't around when the original was made. You were actually... in Vietnam. If I have the story straight, you had met George Romero right before the movie, but you had already enlisted and...
Right, I enlisted in the Army on the hold program, which means they have 140 days. You can be called in within 140 days. So I met George Romero. We talked about doing the film. I showed him my portfolio, and he was all, you know, I would have worked on the film. But they called me in, and I was in the Army and in Vietnam when he really filmed it.
So you were a combat photographer in Vietnam?
Uh-huh.
So that means that you were seeing... the real thing. I mean, in terms of gore and violence, and what was your visceral reaction to having to photograph the wounded?
Well, it was a visceral reaction. I think everybody who I came in contact with over there who was experiencing that, most of us were able to turn off our emotions. It became necessary to turn off the emotions. Those that didn't. We're in big trouble, emotionally, mentally. It's not something that's easy to do. I think your body, you know, if you're in an accident, your body, you go into shock and your body takes over and tries to protect you. I think your mind does the same thing in that situation. My mind took over, turned off my emotions, and I was able to look through the camera. Looking through the camera lens was also a help, because through the lens I could pretend and see it as special effects. And it did affect my work. Some people think that my makeup work began as a result of Vietnam, but no. When I was 12, I saw Man of a Thousand Faces, and from that day on, I wanted to be a makeup artist. But what Vietnam did to me is there's a certain positioning of a body or an expression on the face, a clenching of the fist, of even a severed arm that I almost stepped on one day, that if I don't get the same kind of feeling when I see in my effects work, then to me it's not realistic enough. And I think that might be the edge that as a makeup artist I conveyed, you know, or added to my effects, and thereby getting that moniker, the king of gore, you know.
What kind of photographs were you called on to take when you were in Vietnam?
And I wasn't on the front lines, but if something happened, my job was to go in after a battle or a fracas and photograph damage to equipment and people.
I'm wondering what it was like for you to do movie versions of this after having seen real pain, after having seen the real suffering of it, and especially to do it in some of the movies that were, either more exploitative or more campy in their approach to it.
Well, it's interesting. I don't think I've ever gone in depth about talking about this sort of thing. But as you were saying that, I was thinking, okay, when I was there, I had to turn off my emotions. And when I got home, my emotions stayed turned off. It's not something that clicks back on so easily. It's almost like in Deer Hunter. Suddenly they're at the wedding and zoom, the very next frame, they're in Vietnam and they're in the middle of a fracas. And that's what it seemed like. I mean, I got on the plane, I went there, but suddenly, boom, my mind was there immediately. And then when I came home, it's the same thing. Boom, it was almost like I didn't remember getting there or I remember coming home. And my first marriage suffered, and I was divorced because of my Vietnam experience, I think, because I was emotionless when I came back. Suddenly, I think about a year later, I saw a sunset, and that marked, to me, the beginning of feeling something again. So now here I'm doing movies, and I'm doing this gore and this splatter. I wonder if I suddenly zoomed back into that emotionless state. No, I don't think so, because when we're doing it, we said things like, God, we can inflict this on the audience. Wait till they see this. But mostly, we were creating something that we felt was artistically correct and was going to be dynamic. And only when we would be sitting in the movie theater watching the audience was it like, wow, yes, oh, gee, look what we're doing to these people. I can't, believe. When we were doing it, we wouldn't think about that. But when we were sitting in the theater, that's when it came to us. God, they're really affected by this stuff,
Have you ever felt that you were not being true to the real suffering that you saw by recreating the suffering for movies?
Not being true to the real suffering. Well, if it was a Vietnam picture, then I would have some input. I think I would have to say if I thought something wasn't being filmed correctly, something that show what the way it really happened or what really went on. But in these horror fantasy films, it's just a roller coaster ride, and it never really got that serious. Most people saw it for what it was, fantasies and adventures. The films that dealt with films like Maniac or films that I'm actually afraid to watch, like Henry, The Portrait of a Serial Killer, things that deal with creeps who really exist out there, that's things that I don't want to see that stuff, I want to go to a movie to escape, not to be reminded about the 6 o'clock news.
So you haven't seen Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer?
No. I cast
Tom
Polt.
You cast one of the co-stars in it, yeah.
I did, but I cast him mainly because of our conversations on the phone, the photographs he sent me. I knew I wanted Harry to be repugnant, and when I met Tom in New York and read him with other actresses, and also physically, he was the right type. He was balding. But the film itself, from what I hear, I'm just kind of afraid to watch it. It's not a music video on death. It's kind of a realistic portrayal, a very overly violent thing. It's a very subdued, from what they tell me, it makes me afraid to see it,
Tom Savini is my guest, and he's one of the wizards of special effects makeup. He's worked on all of George Romero's movies, with the exception of Night of the Living Dead, but now he has made a kind of updated remake of Night of the Living Dead. It's Tom Savini's debut as a director. You must have been pretty wacky as a kid, when you started doing this, when you were still in your early teens, running around shopping for blood and pulling a lot of stunts, I'd imagine, in school and maybe in your family.
Well, obviously the when you do this sort of thing, the outlet for practical jokes increases, you know,
like, yeah,
by
also,
leaps and bounds,
yeah.
You know. And I was wacky as a kid. After I first saw that movie, Man of a Thousand Faces, I mean, I was shining shoes in my neighborhood to get money to buy makeup supplies. I lived and breathed makeup. I was reading everything I could about how they would... I asked my cousin one day, I said, how do they put the hair onto werewolves when they do that in a movie? And he said, spirit gum. Most people know what spirit gum is. It's a stage adhesive. You know. I thought he said spearmint gum, okay? I'm 12 years old. So if you can imagine me chewing spearmint gum and trying... And this can't be right, you know? So I was trying to learn how to do this stuff. And I would make up friends of mine, you know, with scars and burns and wounds. And, you know, a lot of times I would never be invited back to their homes, you know, their parents. No, I don't want that Savini kid around. He's crazy, you know.
Right, right. Can you explain how you create scars and wounds?
Ever since the silent movies, there's a chemical called collodion. It's a non-flexible plastic substance that you brush on. It's a liquid. And what it does is it attaches itself to your skin and then contracts. So if you remember Tom Berenger in Platoon, mm-hmm. or Donald Pleasance in the James Bond film where he played Dr. Blofeld, that deeply recessed impression of the skin is collodion. And if it's wounds and things, then, you know, you make a cast of the person's arm or face, wherever the wound is going to appear, and you actually sculpt, anatomically correct wounds and duplicate them in foam latex rubber, glue those on to the person's face or, you know, arm, whatever it is, color them, you know, the way they should be, paint them the way they should be, add the KY lubricating jelly for the sheen and the blood, and that's basically how to do it, but it actually depends on what the script calls for.
You really have to know a lot of techniques, both of art and medicine, probably. For instance, like when you're doing fangs, you have to cast somebody's teeth as if you were a dentist.
A special makeup technician today who was worth anything is a sculptor, a painter, a mold maker, has to know something about mechanics. He has to be a dental technician, a chemist, for all the formulas for chemicals and for appliances and for rubber bladders, you know. You have to be somewhat of a psychologist because you're dealing with these actors all the time. I think you need to be a photographer for a sense of composition. It's so a sketch artist. It's so much. I get letters from people, kids, who are maybe 14 or 15, on stationery that says, Joe Blow, special makeup effects artist, and his stuff is very crude. He obviously knows nothing about the stuff. But I hang on to those photos because, you know, years later, I've hired people who started out that way and who have become really wonderful sculptors and makeup artists and mold makers. And most people who want to get into the business, I think they know from what they read that they have to know all that stuff.
Did you ever look at yourself in the mirror with one of your get-ups on and scare yourself?
No, I mainly get scared looking at myself when there's nothing on my face. Just my face, you know.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Tom Savini did the special makeup effects for movies such as Day of the Dead, Martin, Creepshow, and Friday the 13th, and he's just made his feature film directing debut with the remake of Night of the Living Dead. Next time, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Rhodes tells the story of his abusive childhood. It's the subject of his new memoir, A Hole in the World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Jamaica Kincaid has been living in America for almost 25 years, but in her novels and short stories, she keeps going back to her home in the Caribbean. Coming up, Jamaica Kincaid on writing about the place you can never leave. India has the world's largest film industry, and that means they use a lot of movie music. World music critic Milo Miles introduces us to some of the most popular film music in India. And TV critic David Bianculli previews WIOU, a new sitcom from Grant Tinker. It goes behind the scenes at a TV station with low ratings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has called for calm and reconciliation in Israel and Lebanon after a weekend of violent incidents. Barry Schwide reports from the State Department.
Officials expressed shock and disgust at the slaying of three Jews in Jerusalem and of Christian Maronite leader Danny Shamoun and his family in Beirut, Lebanon. The West Bank construction worker seized in the Jerusalem murders was described by State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler as having gone temporarily insane. She said she knew of no inclination to take the matter to the UN, where the Bush administration condemned Israel in the slaying of 19 Palestinians and is urging Israel to receive UN investigators. As for the assassination in Lebanon of Shamoun, his wife, and two children, the State Department said it didn't know who was responsible since no one had claimed responsibility. Spokeswoman Tutwiler condemned the act of violence, however. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
In Paris, U.S. Defense Secretary Cheney has confirmed that Iraq has captured U.S. anti-aircraft Hawk missiles from Kuwait. The Washington Post is reporting that Iraqi military forces captured some 150 of the U.S. missiles after the August 2nd Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. And according to the leader of the Iraqi American Foundation, Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein has agreed to release some sick and elderly American hostages. The Iraqi president has also asked his parliament to consider letting all French hostages leave. An Iraqi sea captain apparently dumped his cargo overboard in the Persian Gulf today rather than return to Iraq. The incident occurred after the ship was stopped and boarded twice by American warships. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Saudi Arabia.
On Sunday, an Iraqi ship, the Al-Bahar al-Arabi, was challenged by the USS O'Brien in the Persian Gulf after a boarding party found a cargo of plywood and steel pipes prohibited by the United Nations sanctions. The captain agreed to return to Iraq. Later, he continued to sail south, shadowed by the same U.S. warship and an Italian frigate. When the Iraqi captain reached the Gulf of Oman, his ship was stopped and boarded again, this time by an Australian and American team. The cargo had vanished, according to a Navy spokesman tonight, apparently thrown overboard between the two challenges. The Iraqi captain was allowed to proceed to a port in Yemen with his empty ship, no longer in violation of the UN sanctions. In Dahran, Saudi Arabia, this is Deborah Amos.
More than 2,000 school children demonstrated today in Paris to protest violence in their schools and a shortage of teachers. The protest was touched off by increasing violence in the public schools of France. Another demonstration is planned for Wednesday. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 5 points to close at 2,516.09 on volume of some 153 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. TV is taking another look at itself. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the new sitcom, WIOU. But first, some of the most widely heard music in other countries is virtually unknown here in the U.S. Few Americans listen to film soundtracks from India, but radio and record stores there are filled with them. World music commentator Milo Miles takes us to hear Indian movie music.
நெஞ்சின் சொந்தம் இது ஒரு உண்மை சொல்லும் பந்தம் ஊமை நெஞ்சின் சொந்தம் இது ஒரு உண்மை சொல்லும் பந்தம் வார்த்தைகள்
When some people want light entertainment and music, they turn to New Age, funky lounge jazz, or vintage Broadway musicals. Me, I like Indian film music these days. Until very recently, when non-soundtrack cassettes began making inroads, almost all of the domestic pop music in India came from film scores. It's rather like when most of the LPs you could find in this country were recordings of Broadway plays or hit movies. Although Indian soundtracks use everything from traditional sitars and tablas to synthesizers and wah-wah guitars, many film songs are quite mainstream and just what you would expect, sort of pop ragas. This is a selection from a Sajjat Ray soundtrack. But even some of these more traditional tunes can get quite wildly melodramatic. The soundtrack songs I find best for easy listening, however, are the weird ones. The film music composers draw on whatever international sources catch their fancy. This number, for example, suggests a mutant Spanish doo-wop from Bombay. It's sung by S.P. Balasubramaniam.
புதுமாப்பிள்ளைக்கு நல்ல யோகமடா, அந்த வண்ண மகள் தான் வந்த நேரமடா.
Indian film directors can work on 10 or more films at the same time. And while the industry turns out hundreds of soundtracks every year, most are done by about a dozen singers. The circle of star vocalists is nearly a closed shop. The queen of them all is Lata Mangeshkar. Between 1948 and 1984, Mangeshkar made more than 30,000 recordings for over 2,000 films, and in more dialects and languages than she can remember. Every other female singer in Indian movies that I've heard imitates her. The great pleasure of Indian film scores are their unexpected turns of style and their sheer pleasure and entertainment. Big string sections and tabla drums are widespread, but a single song can switch from raging electric guitar accompaniment to melancholy accordion to proud bleeding trumpet. The vocals run through all the thrills, chills, heartbreak, and slapstick you remember from classic Hollywood. Best of all, they let you hear modern pop forms like syrupy ballads and road songs in a new way. These soundtracks are truly where there is no east or west, only the big love scene and the catchy theme song.
Chinna chinna roja puve chella kanne niyar tappi vanda sippi mutte unnai petta thayar solli kolla.
Indian soundtracks are rare in this country. Most record stores stock only classical Indian music. The British EMI label and Oriental Records of New York put out good collections if you can find them. Your best bet, however, is, if you can, to visit local Indian grocery stores, which will often carry inexpensive cassettes. The anthologies on the Double Apple label have the cleanest sound and the biggest stars.
Milo Miles contributes articles on pop music to the New York Times and the Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. Writer Jamaica Kincaid grew up on the Caribbean island of Antigua. It's 9 miles wide by 12 miles long. Her novel, Annie John, was about growing up there. Her book, A Small Place, compared a tourist view of Antigua with the Antigua she knew coming of age in a poor family. Kincaid left the island as a teenager. She moved to New York to work for a prosperous family taking care of their children. Her new novel, Lucy, is based on that experience. It's her first book set outside of Antigua.
Actually, I have to say, everyone assumes it's the United States. I never say it is. And I never say the city, which everyone assumes it's New York. And I didn't want the book to be about these places. I wanted it to focus very much on the girl. And the reason is that she's really someone not about the place she's in. She's about the place she's from always. And I think that I meant to say that this is someone who might possibly spend the rest of her life trying to get rid of something that was impossible.
Do you feel that way about yourself, that you're about
Yes.
where you're from?
Yes. I do.
I guess your name reflects that. That's not the Jamaica Kincaid isn't the name you were given when you were born.
No, I've never liked the name I was given before I knew it was possible not to like such a thing. And by the time I changed my name, it was no longer because I didn't like it. When I started to write, I didn't want my mother, my family, to know that I was doing this thing that possibly might turn out very badly and very embarrassing. And they would just say to me, well, it's just one more thing you try to do that you're not really, you really can't do. And so there, and I didn't want their scorn. So I sort of made up this name.
So you changed your name from Elaine Potter Richardson to Jamaica
Yes.
Kincaid.
Yes.
Was the Jamaica a sign that you really still felt like you were about where you were from?
Well, yes, you know, but I wasn't really, I didn't really have that sort of consciousness. I mean, it really sort of amazes me how I did all these things without, I knew instinctively what to do, but I couldn't have articulated what I was doing. I didn't know, I sort of trusted that it, though I didn't know I was trusting it. I think I'm the sort of person who operates or did when I was younger, more through my will. I just sort of would will these things. It doesn't work as you get older. Actually, as you get older, you need to think. And I think I can do that now. I'm more thoughtful now. But when I was young, I would just sort of will these things. And to my surprise, they worked.
Your novel, Lucy, is about a young woman from Antigua who moves to what I assumed was the United States and works, you know, works for a family there, caring for the children. Now, when you were a teenager, you moved from Antigua to the United States and worked first as a servant and then as an au pair girl. What brought you to the United States and how were you able to get away?
Well, the thing, I came to the United States the way all these people from that part of the world come. You know, you come to work and send most of your salary home to your family, and that's sort of a major part of the economy of these places. I sort of hesitate to claim that I was ever an au pair personally, because as I keep telling people, someone with my complexion and my background is never an au pair. Someone like me is always a servant. How I got out of it, I had some idea of myself, though, as I say again, I couldn't have put it into words. I had an idea that I was just somehow a person living alone, a person living a life that I made up. I had this vague idea. I didn't know what it would turn out to be.
Why did you want to leave your home in Antigua when you were a teenager?
I felt I would die from it, but I also knew that I could never leave it. It's one of those, I think life really is like that. You have to make an effort, even though, you know, it's completely futile. And I never want to be not from Antigua. I am still an Antiguan citizen. I never want to not know these people, but yet I don't want to. You see what I mean?
I think so. I'd like our listeners to hear some of your writing. So let me ask you to read a passage that's about Lucy's relationship with her mother. And this is said after Lucy is working, caring for the children of a white family. And letters have been arriving from her mother, and she refuses to open or to read these letters.
All right. Here. My past was my mother. I could hear her voice, and she spoke to me not in English or the French patois that she sometimes spoke, or in any language that needed help from the tongue. She spoke to me in language anyone female could understand, and I was undeniably that female. Oh, it was a laugh, for I had spent so much time saying I did not want to be like my mother that I missed the whole story. I was not like my mother, I was my mother. And I could see now why, to the few feeble attempts I made to draw a line between us, her reply always was, "You can run away, but you cannot escape the fact that I am your mother. My blood runs in you. I carried you for 9 months inside me." How else was I to take such a statement but as a sentence for life in a prison whose bars were stronger than any iron imaginable? I had at that very moment a collection of letters from her in my room, 19 in all, one for every year of my life, unopened. I thought of opening the letters, not to read them, but to burn them at the four corners and to send them back to her unread. It was an act I had read somewhere of one lover rejecting another, but I could not trust myself to go too near them. I knew that if I read only one, I would die from longing for her.
No, I know when you left Antigua, you didn't see your mother for, I think, 19 years afterwards.
20.
Your mother must have been very powerful to set off such strong feelings.
Yes, she is. She still is. I saw her this spring, for 3 weeks, and everyone said I looked very beautiful, and in fact I could see that I looked really quite wonderful, and even though I was just dying inside, it was really sort of torture because she's just has an amazing effect on me, and so anyway I looked very beautiful, and then she left, and I was sick for one month for every week she was with me, and I just got everything you could get, including a childhood disease, chicken pox.
So. Can you explain why, what effect she has on you?
Well, I sort of try to explain it to myself in these books, in fiction. I think if I could explain it to you, I would never write about it anymore. If I knew what it was, I would never write about it again. And I suspect that I will again in one way or another. I think the thing about this relationship is that it's sort of, it really is one of those, you know, it's sort of a person in love. in this very terrible way. And, you know, it's one of those things, really, that only an absence of memory or an absence of the... an absence of memory, meaning death, really, can end. I don't imagine... I have no desire, really, to be free of this.
I guess I'm really trying to understand whether the feelings about your mother are feelings of love or of hate or some kind of strange mixture of both.
I wouldn't call it a strange mixture. I'd call it a very normal mixture. It would seem to me that they go hand in hand. It would seem to me that... it's impossible to have one without the other. I think not to admit the opposite of that is very odd. I mean, it's not so strange. I think it's very normal.
Mm-hmm. Well, you write that the character knew if she read one of the letters from her mother, she would die from longing for her.
Hmm.
I guess you're not feeling that anymore. I mean, you're old enough to see her when you want to. You're free enough to see her when you want to. It's not the longing, is it?
Yes. Well, it's very, you know, it's very odd because actually every day I think about her in one way or the other. I mean, my life is just really formed by this person. I'm probably a writer because of her. She taught me to read when I was 3.5 years old. She taught me to love books. And the alarming thing, or perhaps ironic thing about that is that eventually this thing that she gave to me is the thing that I used as a weapon against her. But also it's the thing that I have used to save my own self.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your writing. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Jamaica Kincaid's new novel is called Lucy. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today, news of the crisis in the Persian Gulf and Jerusalem, and also a great deal from Capitol Hill, where budget negotiations continue between congressional leaders and representatives of the administration. Also, a special report today from Renee Montaigne in South Africa on what one Afrikaner town did in response to the lifting of apartheid on public facilities, the old bans that segregated swimming pools and drinking facilities. Fountains and public restrooms. In this particular town, when the decree came down, they imposed fees on those facilities and took other steps to try to keep apartheid in effect.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Now that the World Series is over, CBS is back to the business of premiering new shows. The most notable one this week is WIOU, a one-hour comedy drama series set in the TV newsroom of a low-rated, network-affiliated local station. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
One of the first things you ought to know about WIOU is that it comes from GTG Entertainment, the company co-owned by Grant Tinker. Tinker's the guy who, when he ran MTM Productions, gave us another TV show set in a TV newsroom, The Mary Tyler Moore Show. He also gave us a spinoff of that show, television's first official comedy drama series, Lou Grant. And later, as head of NBC, Tinker presided over both Hill Street Blues and L.A. Law. All of those great ghosts return, in spirit, in WIOU. The show opens with a Ted Baxter type, silver hair, golden throat, co-anchoring the news. During a commercial break, he complains of the heat, then keels over.
Please.
No! I'll drive.
I'm dying out here.
Stu, I'll wait outside, I promise.
I really am dying out here.
Oh, guys, will you move the camera up, please?
He was right. Before the opening credits come on, he's dead, paving the way for the other characters to jockey for his suddenly vacated position. It's the same way L.A. Law opened 5 years ago, and WIOU has that show's same outrageous sense of humor. It's demonstrated best when the surviving anchorman, the lecherous Neil Frazier, gives an on-air tryout to one of his potential co-anchors. Harris Yulin plays Neil. Helen Shaver plays Kelby Robinson, the reporter seated next to him.
First, there's more today on the appointment of a school board president. Here with her exclusive report, Kelby Robinson. Kelby?
Neil? I'll tell you all about it just as soon as you take your hand off my thigh. Now. Thank you.
WIOU borrows a lot from the movie broadcast news and from the frenetic style and large ensemble feel of Hill Street Blues. The pilot script is weak on plot, but strong on character, and the casting is downright inspired. It's also, in many cases, somewhat redemptive, giving good parts to a lot of actors who need them. Dick Van Patten, for example, plays a Willard Scott-type weatherman, a bit of casting that's positively, almost perversely, brilliant. Phil Morris, wasted on the new Mission Impossible, finds real work as an egocentric reporter. And Mariette Hartley, who lost her credibility as co-host of CBS's morning show, may regain it by playing the cynical executive producer of the WIOU newscast. At the center of all this is John Shea, playing the brand new news director brought in to run the ship, much the way Lou Grant came to the Trib after jumping from TV to newspapers. Shea is very good, but the best thing about WIOU is that it knows its business. And since viewers now know all about it too, words like ratings and Q scores and lead-ins aren't going to scare anybody off. This inside look at TV news could catch on pretty fast. Film at 11.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Dan Laughlin, and Richard Parker. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The last time we spoke with Richard Rhodes on Fresh Air, it was about his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Making of the Atomic Bomb. On the next Fresh Air, Rhodes tells us about his childhood, when he was beaten and starved by his stepmother. It's the subject of his new memoir. Also, a talk with jazz guitarist Jimmy Rainey. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.